In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks for listening. Please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be chatting shortly with Berence Whitfield, the namesake of Berence Whitfield and the Savages. He's the band's lead singer and frontman. The group started in the early 1980s, playing a mixture of 50s-styled rock and roll and R&B mixed with 60s soul. On hiatus in the early 2000s, they reformed and have been active again since 2011, with their latest album, Glory, coming out on the Spanish label, Folk Records. We hear some of its first track, Bad Situation, and afterwards, I'll be back with Berence for your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
It's a bad situation, and my heart is filled with pain. And I'm so doggone lonely, it's about to drive me insane. I went to see my doctor. He said the trouble, I just can't tell. He said, son, you might get better, but you'll never ever get well.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and my guest today for our coolest conversations is Berence Whitfield, lead vocalist and frontman for Berence Whitfield and the Savages. Their latest album is Glory, and available from Folk Records, F-O-L-C, a Spanish label. Hi, Berence, how are you?
Hey, Manfred, how are you doing?
I'm doing excellent. I'm doing excellent. And you're doing pretty good?
Yeah, I'm fine. You know, last time we saw each other was in España, or Spain, I should say, to our English audience. And, yeah, we had a good time there for a couple of weeks. You know, we pretty much had a really, really nice tour, and I really enjoyed your presence and company for those two weeks.
Thank you very much, Angel. We got to hang out a little bit there, rode together for a couple of days. I thought that was extra cool, and chat some. You know, we just took a listen to Bad Situation, the opening track off your latest album, Glory, and I'm happy that your situation is good, right? It's a good situation.
No bad situations happening over here.
Well, we spoke a couple of times before, and I realized that we hadn't really talked about any of your background in those earlier chats. So I want to get to the new album. First, let's find out some about yourself. Now, you were born in Jacksonville, and then as a child, your family moved to New Jersey. Is that right?
Yeah, I was born in Jacksonville, Florida, and my parents lived in Brunswick, Georgia, which I spent a little bit of time there, and then we did the migration of the 50s and headed to New Jersey because my father had and my mother had relatives living in the Newark East Orange area. So, you know, that's, and we came right on the bus, me and my mommy, and, you know, we ended up in Newark because my father was one of those truck drivers that drove, you know, around the country, oh. you know, doing deliveries and stuff. So, so that's how I came in touch with New Jersey.
Well, let me ask you, so your parents were from New Brunswick. You a fan of Brunswick stew?
I sure am. I've had that many times thanks to my mom cooking it a lot.
Well, how would you describe to somebody who's never had Brunswick stew, what exactly is that?
It's a stew. I haven't eaten in a long time, but what I remember was meat, you know, beef and carrots and onions, and almost like beef stew, only had a different taste than beef stew.
Yeah, generally I always find it at like a barbecue place, so they'll have Brunswick stew if it's in Georgia.
But it was definitely tasty. Between that and collard greens and cornbread, those were our big meals at home.
So this neighborhood in East Orange in Jersey, what was that like, the neighborhood?
Well, growing up, well, first it was in Newark. In Newark, I lived on a one-way. I lived on a one-way street called Beacon Street. It was right in the middle of one of the big avenues in the Newark area, New Jersey area, Springfield Avenue and South Orange Avenue. And I'm sure my neighborhood is not there anymore. But that's why I lived on a street that was a one-way street. Wasn't that long. And it found it for some funny reason, it found its way to have three churches on the same block.
Amen.
Amen. One of them was right across the street from my house, which we went to, and I couldn't get away from church due to the fact that the reverend would come over every morning, knock on the door, and said, Mrs. White, is Barry coming to church this morning? Yes, he's coming to Sunday school, all that. So I was locked in. It was like, you know, once he made his appearance at my front door, get the suit on, get ready.
And so this was the church that's literally right across the street out of the three on the street.
Literally right across the street. You couldn't miss it. I couldn't miss it. The Lord wouldn't miss it.
Well, you were singing in church, right? Was that part of a choir? Or when did you start singing in church?
I started singing, at the church in the choir. I was just, doing my background choir thing. And what we did, did that pretty much every Sunday. And sometimes there'd be a Saturday late evening thing going on, and I'd sing too. But pretty much my starting was listening to a lot of gospel music that my mother would play on the radio, local radio station called WNJR, Newark, New Jersey. And I couldn't touch that radio for at least three hours. If I did that, I'd lose my hand. Or all she had to tell me was, "You're not going to touch that radio. Don't touch that radio."
But otherwise, were you listening to the radio a lot when you were a kid?
I sure did. And that's where I got to listen to a lot of my soul, and some rock and roll and blues. The NJR was the big station, but also the New York stations were really big. So I got to listen to ABC, MCA, all those wonderful, wonderful stations of the time. And so there was always music going on in my house, no matter what.
Did you take any instrument lessons when you were a kid?
I played a little bit of drums. I didn't take much lessons, because I always liked to sing. I was always the kind of guy that would love to get out there and want to sing loud and be heard. And, I didn't start screaming out my guts as far as that part of my life started to evolve until I listened to James Brown, Wilson Pickett, and Claude Jeter. of the, I think they were Swan Silvertones, yeah.
And so, do you have any siblings?
I do. Well, unfortunately, I've lost two in the last few years. I had a sister and brother who were born right after me, who one died of cancer and the other one died of kind of like a diabetes type of thing. So right now I have two sisters and a brother.
And did any of your sisters or brothers, did they play or sing?
My sister in the middle, her name is Gail. She played clarinet for the orchestra in high school and stuff. So, but everybody else was more or less listeners. They weren't players, you know. And I never thought I'd become the player until, back in the day when I got together with a few friends and we put together this little band in the early 70s called the Funkasonics. We named them after
the Funkasonics. I have not heard about the Funkasonics before. Was this in high school?
This was outside our high school. Because we loved Funkadelic, and so, you know, we'd do I'll Betcha and all those early Funkadelic tunes, and I Want to Testify, and we'd do all the routines and everything. So we named ourselves the Funkasonics.
Well, cool. So in the Funkasonics, you were singing?
Yes, I was. I was singing lead and doing routines with three other guys, but I was singing a lot of the lead songs. So, and we do the Temptation stuff and Four Tops and, you know, songs of that era. We had fun. Okay, yeah. We were having fun.
How often did you play out?
We played out a little bit. I mean, we didn't play professionally. We played certain places, you know, picnics, little shows that are in our school, you know, our school auditorium and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So it was definitely we were having fun, man. We were definitely we felt like we were superstars.
Well, so you're performing, but that wasn't, correct me if I'm wrong, that wasn't what you were thinking in terms of a long-term career. You had an interest in like journalism, right?
Oh, I sure did. I wanted to be a television journalist that was because I admired like Huntley and Brinkley and Walter Cronkite and all these journalists. And I said, that looks like an easy job, but it's one of those jobs that you have to have the passion for, you have to have the knowledge for. But, you know, I feel like I was the person that could talk to people, and I was good debater in school, so I can debate people in different forums. And so, I mean, that's what I went for, but I don't know, music kind of was holding my back pocket and pulling me back.
Well, that interest in music and pursuing that was kind of facilitated it. We talk about Baron Swift and the Savages by you pursuing your journalism studies there in the Boston area, right? What college is it that takes you up to Boston?
Oh, BU. Okay. But I didn't spend very much time there due to you know what? It was really funny. I got in through scholarships, so I was lucky, but I still didn't feel it was what I really wanted to do. And I always had music on the side. I was listening to a lot of music. I was going to see shows, and I was, you know, involved in some sort of musical thing, whatever. And I think it was always in the back of my head. And then finally, when I finally, you know, after a brief period of being out of school and working around Boston, working in used record stores, and I finally hooked up with a job being a security guy mm-hmm. At this department store, and I finally felt I kept going to the record department in the store. I just couldn't, I guess something just clicked off in my head and said, that's it. I'm tired of roaming around figuring out this is what I want to do. Now I've got to find a way to hook up with maybe some musicians or someone. And I got lucky with Peter Greenberg. I really got lucky due to the fact that he worked at the same used record shop that I worked at the time called Nuggets. And one of his friends that worked there heard me singing. They said, man, you got a pretty decent voice. And I was just, you know, doing what I normally do, just singing with records and stuff. And he said, there's a guy that's looking for a singer, black singer, who could sound like Little Richard. And I think you're the kind of guy, I think you could pull it off. So he got us together with Peter, and we got together, and he didn't even audition me. Basically, we went and we went, sat down, had chili, started talking in his at his place, and next thing you know, he was playing these songs that he wanted to do in this next band, because he was telling me his history of being with DMZ and the Liars and what kind of music they were playing. So the first record he plays for me is Mama Get the Hammer, Flies on the Baby's Head. And I went, what is this?
So you had not, you weren't familiar with that tune at that point?
No, I was not familiar with anything that was coming my way. He was playing me, you know, Smiley Lewis, you know, material, and, you know, all these wild screaming rockers. And then he played this tune for me called The Wild Hog Hop by Benny Hess. And I said, this is it. This sounds really fun and interesting. And before I could say that, he already had me. He said, you're in the band, you know, Papa. I don't need to audition you. I believe in you.
Man, that's way cool. Way cool. And so, I was going to say that, and you alluded to this earlier when you referred to the minister talking to your mom as Mrs. White, and yourself, your name Barry. So your real name is Barry White. So how did you?
Yeah, my real.
Go ahead.
How did I make Barry White Barons Whitfield?
Yeah,
it was clever actually. When I was in high school, these kids used to tease me by, instead of calling me Barry, they would call me like, you know, like Murgatroyd or something like. Then they got this name Barons. He said Barons. Barons, like I'm a high echelons of royalty of some sort with money or whatever their thought was. So I kind of liked the name. And so I said, you know what? If I ever get famous, I'll change my name from Barons, from Barry to Barons, not knowing that at the time, later on in my high schooling, there was this famous singer named Barry White who became an icon in the black community, in the music community and stuff. So all the girls used to get close to me because my name was Barry White. They'd call it out in the classroom, and all these girls would turn around and go, "Ooh, Barry White!" You know. So I, for that part I liked. But then when it was time to put the Savages together, I thought of the Bar. I said, "I got to bring Baron Whitfield out and see," and so we did. And
well, where does the Whitfield part come from?
It comes from the producer Norman Whitfield, who produced like in Motown,
you know, guy that did the second half of the Temptation stuff, right? Like Smokey Robinson,
yeah. But you know, he wrote a lot of early stuff for the Motown as well,
yeah.
But that last name, I said, well, if I take White and put Field, that's Whitfield, and I take the Y out of Barry, put Ian, you know, it'll fit. And I told the band that, I said, oh, that sounds interesting. And, you know, there wasn't any other Barons Whitfields out there at the time. So
has anyone ever mistook you for being Barry White?
I had an experience. Well, you know, it wasn't even mistaking me for Barry White. Again, with the name, it was It was a flight between the United States, stopping in Amsterdam, and then going on to Finland. So just once I got stopped, this guy who worked for the airlines, I think it was Northwest, but anyway, it was an African gentleman, and he stopped. He saw my name on my passport, and immediately he went, "Oh my God, it's Betty White! What are you doing here, Betty White?" And I said, "Well, I'm taking a plane." He looks at my ticket, and he goes, why are you sitting in regular seats, Mr. White?" I said, "Well, this is how they said it." "Well, wait a minute. We will change that." So within 10 minutes, he comes out. "You have first class all the way from your travels, round trip." And I went, "Thank you." And he started bringing me food. And he kept taking pictures of us going, "Betty, I can't believe I'm with Betty White. Oh, my God."
He was with Betty White.
I couldn't lie to him. I mean, my name is Betty White. I'm not that Betty White, but I am Betty White. And while I'm waiting for the flight to come, he's being very nice, being honest. So I shake his hand, get on the plane. He was just shaking his head in astonishment. And I go to my first class seat, and this stewardess comes over and says, "Mr. White, I'll be your stewardess, and whatever you want is through the airlines, first class." I said, "Well, what do I want?" I said, "Let me have I was going to get a drink, and I got, what was it? Oh my God, what was the drink? It was kind of like a coffee chocolate drink, but yeah, they treated me with like I was like a superstar, and I was going, I can't, you know what? My mom won't believe this. A few other friends probably won't believe this, but who cares? I'm taking this to the limit."
All right, so the Savages form, and Peter Greenberg's on guitar, and as you mentioned, he had played in DMZ, The Liars, really legendary Boston bands. Phil Lenker on bass, who also played with The Liars, and formed the that original version of the band, and since reforming, you've had one album on Munster, three on Bloodshot, the current one on Folk. Let's talk some about let me ask you this. So with Phil and Peter, you do a couple of albums, and then those guys leave, and you continue the band on with different players. And and then since that time, those guys have come back. And as I said, you put out several albums, including the new one. So why did Peter and Phil leave? And why did you wind up reforming the band with other musicians?
Peter left because he just went back to school. He wanted to get a degree. He wanted to, he wanted to get a legitimate job, I guess, you know, and, do his thing, you know. And he put music on the back burner for a while. And then Phil, we hung out for another 6 months, and then we got another guitar player. But then after that, we just said, okay, that's it. I think that will be, you know, we just said that was it. We just didn't want to do it anymore. And so I was left without a band for about 4 months. And then I wanted to continue. I wanted to continue doing it. So I hooked up with some other musicians, and we took a while to, it wasn't the same like the first band, but it was different in a way that it was a little bit more polished than what we were with Peter and and Phil. And also we had in that first band was a guy named Howie Ferguson on drums, who was a original real kid.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, he was with us for about 3 years. That was a really tight, crazy, that was a good band. That was really good. And then the next one became very good, and we did some other albums after that. Got a little bit more popular because we were playing all over the place and in Europe. And then I didn't see running back to Peter, I'm sorry to say, for about 26 years. It was a 26-year period where he was working in the corporate, you know, doing well. But I think he really wanted to, you know, get back into music. And he was doing well monetarily and stuff and working hard. So finally, we were talking about putting out the first album again, you know, reissuing it. And then we started talking about getting back. He wanted to get back together again. At the time, he was living in New Mexico. And so he flew me and Phil out to his home in New Mexico. And next thing you know, man, it was like we were doing it all over again. It was like 26 years later, and here we are, probably in our 50s, like rehashing. But you know what? When we finally got it together and really rehearsed, and it was like it never left. It was right back to 1983-84, but this was 2011 maybe. So it was like, oh my God, it just felt good again. And then we was looking for a record label, and we got Munster to put out one of the first records coming back.
Right.
That was Savage Kings. And then Bloodshot really wanted to do something. And I mean, let's face it, it's always been Savages have always been a good entity in Europe, and really liked, because I guess we played the real hard, crazy covers of the 50s and the 60s, but in a garagey kind of rock way, and people dug it.
Well, let's talk some about the new album. And you mentioned first Munster as kind of a comeback album. That's a Spanish label. And again, there's that European connection. And the current album is on Folk, which is also a Spanish label. So when and where did you record Glory, the Folk album?
We recorded Glory about a year. Was it a year? Yeah, almost. No, the year before last. We recorded it. What was the name of the? Oh my God! The city there. Oh my God!
But it was overseas. You did it overseas.
It was in Spain. It was in Spain. It was right. We had done almost a 4-week tour, and then after the tour, Valencia. We went to Valencia, and everything was all set up. You know, studio, Airbnb, everything. And as we were touring, we were just listening and putting our minds together of the songs that we were going to do. And then, you know, we were doing some of them in our set. So by the end of the tour, we were kind of ready to just go in there and just whip it out. So we went to this wonderful studio in Valencia and just dedicated the whole week and just whipped it out like that. It was unbelievable how we went in there and just was focused and just energetic and was ready to record.
And so Mike Maraconda produced it?
Yes, Mike Maraconda produced it. He was an old friend going back to the days of the Raunch Hands, a band he was in out of New York City. And he always said that when he played with us, and he said, oh, you guys were fantastic. He said, and then he goes back to his band, had a meeting, and said, listen, we got to be like Baron Spitfield and the Savages. That's the band that we have to be like. he was just blown away by just the power of the playing and, you know, just everything about the Savages. So
I wanted, sorry to interrupt, but I'm trying to get an idea. What is Mike like as a producer? Is he very hands-on with arrangements, or was he more focused on, you know, how things were recorded and sounds? Like, what ways did he produce the album?
I think everything, what you said, he was a little bit hands-on certain things, but he was definitely energetic as far as getting us to do our best and to get what he knew he could get out of a Savage performance in the studio. So he really worked hard in us making sure that we were able to pull off and play and get things together, arrangement-wise or just playing-wise or just, you know. He was really good at that. And I think he did a really good job in the studio with us, you know, because he knew us. He knew us from back in the day. And it's always good to, when you're working with a producer, for a guy who knows your sound, who knows what you should sound like, what he could get out of you. So I thought he did a tremendous job on this record. I mean, especially for the time we were in the studio.
Right, for the week. So over half the album is originals, the rest are covers. So whose record collection got rated for the cover tunes?
Both of ours, me and Peter's. Oh, well, yeah. Peter always pulls out some good stuff. And then I had this one song I wanted to do by Bobby Comstock for Right Hand Man. So
I'm glad you mentioned that, because we'll go out with that one. But, you know, so I looked that one up and I figured out that he did that. But like the Bad Situation, who did that originally?
Who was that? It actually really never came out. It was a demo, and it was what's the guy who did? Oh my God, I'm gonna have to go to my collection here for the library, and I can tell you who it is now. I know he's out of Chicago, and he was definitely. Oh, here it is. See, I pulled it out.
Yeah,
Harold Barrage.
Oh,
who actually recorded for Cobra, and he was a Chicago blues guy.
Did and he ever do stuff on Chess too?
He might have a few things on Chess, maybe a couple things.
But something on Chess, but well, that's not fair, Barrett. If you're able to dig up the demos, that's way. I mean, it's really cool. But I mean, I'm really curious as to what his demo of that song sounded like. And how did you wind up with a demo of Harold Barrage?
Well, it was on a bootleg record that Peter had that he really liked. And he said, we could do it better. Because the version that he pulled off wasn't that great. It was okay. But Peter felt we could do a better interpretation of the song. So I'd never heard it, and I was surprised. I was shocked. So what we did a little bit of a different arrangement, but we kept to the roots of the song. And it was when we finished it, we were going, wow, this is better than Harold Barrage.
Oh, what a killer. It's a killer tune. And you know, so but for a moment I'm going to digress, because you know, here in Los Angeles, I have a side project band, The Magnificent, and what's funny to me is that do sort of rock and soul stuff, and then you know, your records would come out, and I would be like, oh my God, they're doing that song. That's the song we do, and it's just, you know, great minds thinking alike, and I think it was very special when we were playing together. Through this, and you mentioned us playing together in Spain and stuff, that you would call me up on stage and we would do that tune Pain together, because that was a highlight for me every evening. And I'm going on about this now, because on the new record you do a version of that Freddie Scott I'll Be Gone, and and so the completely independently, our guitar player was like, oh, I've always wanted to do this song, and I'm like, man, Marantz has beat us to the punch yet again.
Well, that was another Peter pick from one of his 45 collections. As you can probably tell, between me and Peter and Phil, we're extensive record guys, especially me and Peter. Everywhere we go, we sniff out record stores. It's just like we go on the phone. We go, okay, we're going to be in so-and-so. They're a record shop. We both look. He said, it's 15 minutes away. And we get lucky sometimes if it's right next door or around the corner. And then Peter will make sure everything is all set, waiting for the summit. We're just going to go around the corner.
Well, I was with you on one of those trips, and I thought it was funny that we were in Spain, and we're going to a small independent record shop, and the guy running it is just like, you know, that record store could have been anywhere, and the sort of the mentality of the guy running it is that that's that record store guy, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, you'll find them. I found record stores in places I'm going, what is this store doing here, you know? And sometimes other countries are better with record stores. I find, you know, places like the Netherlands, Holland, England, Germany, they're good for records. Japan, I found some good stuff. Australia, you know, I mean, and usually we get, you know, promoters or they go, Barons, we know that you want to collect 45s. We know of a good record store. And then Peter's right behind me goes, ding, something goes off of the record list. There's a story once of when Peter was with the Liars and they're in a moving car and they're getting close to this record store, but there's no parking. And so, there's no parking. I'm going to have to. And next thing you know, he kind of flies out the moving car and runs right across the street to the record store.
Oh, man. Okay, so we've been talking about some of the covers. Let's talk about some of the original tracks. And speaking of Peter, I think he co-wrote this and want to find out who he wrote it with. It's like the second cut on the album on Glory. It's Cape May Diamond. It's credited to Greenberg and Mooney. Who's this guy that he wrote the song with?
Michael Mooney is our, like, how can I call Michael Mooney? He's kind of like our guru. He lived in New Mexico at the time with Peter, and he was in a band with Peter called Mambi's Head, which I can explain it, but it's a long story, but... you'd have to get it from him. He could do the best interpretation of why they call themselves Mambi's Head. But and he was into a lot of crazy stuff about music, but he always wrote these lyrics that were really, really fascinating. He's the one that also wrote The Corner Man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Corner Man. It's a good tune, yeah.
He wrote The Corner Man from one of our other albums. But we'd always have at least two Michael Mooney records, because he would work with Peter, and they'd go over his house, and he'd work out the guitar parts, and he'd work out the lyrics. And he also wrote a tune called Oscar Levant, and it was about the actor / piano player, classical pianist, who was I don't know, he's kind of weird, but his name is Oscar Levant. He was in An American in Paris, and he was in a lot of musicals in the late 40s, but he was also a great concert pianist, fantastic pianist. But Mike Mooney wrote
American
a song
in Paris. I saw American in Paris recently on like an airplane, and I'm remembering a piano player in that. So that's the guy?
That's the guy, Oscar Levant.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, he was famous. But he had a side of him that was a little bit weird and crazy, you know, stuff. But Michael Mooney wrote one song about him, and I thought it was fabulous, his lyrics and stuff. But
what is Cape May Diamond about?
Cape May Diamonds, from what I heard from Peter, is about Mike Mooney's honeymoon from Boston all the way down to Cape Ann to all the way down to Florida, his escapades. And so I said, oh, interesting song. Cape May Diamond ain't worth a thing. Okay.
Is he still married?
No. He is, as a matter of fact, I think he's looking to move. If he hasn't done it already, he's looking to move to New Orleans.
Now, will that be a healthy place for him to be living?
Well, I think for him, yes. Because I think he has some ailments, but also he just needs to get away from get away from New Mexico. So I haven't talked to him in a very, very long time, but he was a very interesting guy, man. He definitely he had some interesting things to say politically and non-politically. So it was definitely a person you'd listen to and you went, okay, you know, all right. But go ahead. What are you going to say?
Oh no, I was going to ask about your drummer Andy Joni, because he's also contributed a couple of songs to the album, "Hey Miss Glennis" and "Killing Time." And I was curious, how long has Andy been playing with you guys now?
He started playing when we got, you know, back together around 2010. I think he played. He's from Cincinnati. Well, yeah, he lives in Cincinnati. He's from Cincinnati. And I think Peter played some shows with him and just loved his drumming and his attack mode and everything. So he really hyped him up. And he also not only plays drums, but he plays guitar, plays bass, plays a little bit of keyboards, as you notice on that one song we were talking about, "Killing Time." So he's very talented, and at the time when we got together, he was a little bit younger than we were, especially our sax player Tom Quartulli. They were the youngsters, and we were the we were the elder statesmen of rock and roll.
So they were the kids.
They were the kids.
And they're still the kids. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how old they get. They're always going to be younger. They're the kids.
Well, they're still the kids, even though they're in their 40s now. no, it was a great collection to get him and Tom, and you know, just rehearsed a lot as we were getting back together and getting good material to record and stuff. So it was,
well, let me ask about, so you brought up Tom, the sax player, and he's not from Cincinnati. He's from the Boston area, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a Worcester guy.
So how did he wind up playing with you guys when you reformed? Because he wasn't playing with you earlier, or was he?
How did we hook it up? Because I think I might have played with him on a gig, and we were just looking for a sax player that had gritty, and his name came up, and we listened to him audition. He worked out just fine, you know. So I mean, it's just like when you're looking for guys, and then they just walk right, you know, out of the blue. That's the guy. We should get him.
That's the guy.
You know, not look any further. I think there were a few other saxophone players, but I think he was very gritty and very knowledgeable and a good player. So we kind of lucked out on getting him.
Well, I want to ask you about some more about Phil, the bass player, because he was there when you and Peter first formed the band, and he's been writing original tunes since the very early days, including Bloody Mary, which is, you know, kind of a live show staple. And on the new album, one of his contributions is "I Do My Best to Survive." And I love the song, but it's like, it's confusing me. It's like, what the hell is going on in there? Something about his lady kissing the man with the animal face and the creature with three heads. what is happening? And I do my best to survive, because it winds up, it ties back into, you know, playing 45s. What is going on in that tune?
Well, you know, Phil's got a incredible imagination that sometimes we have to step two steps back and kind of figure out what he's talking about. He knows what he's talking about, but we have to say, as we're listening to it, wait a minute, what's he talking about? So he explains it a little bit about, you know, life as it is and, you know, all the pleasures of life. And then there's the other side where, you know, you do your best to survive from all this stuff that's going around in your life. So, but I always thought that the song should be called You Kiss the Man with the Animal Face, but yeah. 'Cause that's the main, for me, that's the main line in the song.
Yeah.
You know, when you hear that, you go, wow, you know, that, you know, but he really could take certain, you know, phrases and lines and, you know, he, you know, he's always thinking, 'cause when we were riding around during the tour, he had a notebook and he was, you know, changing little words here and lines here and stuff to fit it into something that he understands and
right.
he wants to portray to us to and then show us how to play it and show us how to maybe enunciate a word or a line. Or it's all Phil all the time. So he has a, like I said, unusual, you know, not only sense of humor, but just like a thought process that I couldn't have, that's for sure.
So earlier this year, we alluded to this one. I mean, we spoke about this briefly. My band, the Woggles, played with you guys for a couple of weeks in Spain. Went really well. And you mentioned, you know, you've always had a lot of success playing over in Europe. But when you first went overseas, now that was to the UK. Is that right? And then,
yes,
and that somehow was... the BBC presenter, I guess DJ Andy Kershaw, had a hand in bringing over there.
Yes, he did. As a matter of fact, he heard us. He heard our first album from a guy named, I think his name was Wiggy, or he's a trumpet player. He played with Billy Bragg, who Andy Kershaw was Billy Bragg's guitar tech for a little while there.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, before he heavily started getting into the radio thing. But the record was, because we were very popular in the D.C. area, Baltimore, D.C. area. So Wiggy found this record, and they told him, oh, you got to hear this band. They're from Boston. Blah, blah. So he brought it back to Andy, back to England. He played it on his radio program, and he said, well, first he played it at his house, and he said his head went through the ceiling. And then he went and played it on his program on the BBC, and he just was just a follower. He just kept talking about us. So finally one day, and he called the number on the record and talked to my manager, Andy Doherty, who was the manager at the time, and he just kept raving, this greatest rock and roll band. Oh, this album is great, blah, blah. And he just kept talking. So finally, he calls back 3 months later, said, I can't stand it. I'm coming over to Boston. I want to meet the man. I want to see the band. Everything. So he flew over, and he told his radio audience in London, he will be back with the man, with the treasure, the jewel of rock and roll. So he came over. He had a great time, heard the band. We went back home with tons of records from our old label, Rounder, who had a little side record store called Roundup Records. Mm-hmm. I went left Boston with stacks of LPs, and so that was it. He kept playing us on the radio, and then a booking agent hooked us up and brought us over for a week. But he came over to see us the first time when Peter with the original band was there. So he saw the original band. So he was very lucky at that point. And in the midst of all that, come to find out when we were brought over to England, the record got into the hands of a gentleman named Robert Plant, who was very adamant about wanting to be Baron Swiftfield and the Savages.
And did he do so?
He did. Over there, he came. As a matter of fact, he asked, Andy was doing a show, a live thing, at this club in Camden Town. And he called up Andy and said to him, listen, I love Baron Swiftfield and the Savages. I think this band, this record is fantastic. I just want to ask you a question. I hear he's coming to play live. Is it possible that I could get on the guest list? And then Andy went, bloody hell, just show up. You don't need to be on no guest list. Just show up. And he showed up. Loved the show. Really, really a nice guy. Knows his music. For people out in radio land, Plant knows he loves his rock and roll, whether it be 50s blues or 60s folk. He loves music. He's a dedicated follower of the thing they call music.
You know, so you mentioned Robert Plant here. That reminds me, when we were riding around together, you had a story about meeting R. Crumb, which I think people would enjoy hearing that.
The year before last, I think we were in France, and I have a friend here in, excuse me, I just kissed my wife goodbye.
Bye, honey.
Anyway, hi, honey. But anyway, so yeah, a friend of mine who's from State College in Pennsylvania, who's a professor at Penn State, was an old friend of R. Crumb, and he used to come over and do record runs with him, and he recorded some shows with him and stuff. So we happened to be in France near Montpellier. We were playing in Montpellier, and he lives not far from there. And I said, we're going through. I said, you think R. Crumb would love to have us over his place for a little bit? He said, I'll call and find out. So he called, and he got back in touch with me. He said, here's his number. Give him a call. I think you're fine to go over there, but he wants to hear from you. I said, oh, thanks, man. I can't believe it. So I called him. He said, yeah, come on over. Let's hang out. And we were like little boys jumping in the van going, ah, we're going to meet R. Crumb. Oh, my God. I was very proud of myself to make that happen because, you know, it was so cool. And we got to his place, and we had to go over this little bridge to go over to his little village. And he said he'd meet us halfway. So we're walking, and all of a sudden I look up the hill, and they all said, is that him? And there's a man coming down the hill with a hat on, straw hat on, long blue, light blue shirt, jeans, and that walk. And I said, that's it. That's him. And so he was so nice, let us stay at his house. We were there for a little over an hour, met his wife, who 3 months later, unfortunately, she passed away from cancer. But we got to meet her. And we just had a joyful time hanging out, talking about music, and you know, it was very, very, very nice. It was took pictures, and it was one of the most again for me. You talk about a bucket list. That was main bucket list for me to meet R. Crumb.
So did he show you any? Did he whip out any 78s and say, "Oh, you guys should cover this"?
Well, no, I looked at his record collection, and he had like a wall of 78s. I just was in awe of that. But I'm just looking at a lot of little artifacts that he had in this room. Like he had this artifact of, was a little doll of Trump that when you press his stomach, his eyes bulge out, his tongue comes out, look like he's about to explode. And I said, oh, I wish we all could do this. And I was pressing him. And, you know, he had all this other unbelievable artwork. He had a a framed picture of, you know, the Last Supper. I looked at it closely, and instead of, you know, food being on the table, there was all naked women. And I'm going, guys, you got to see this picture. And it was just like all these weird, wild, but it was just fascinating to be in his apartment. So, yeah, I would say we had that. The rest of the trip was like, okay, we've done it. We've got to see it. R. Crumb, and everything else is secondary now.
You played a couple of shows in the Northeast recently at the Bowery Electric in New York City. Where else did you play?
Well, we played in Portland, Maine, this place called Space. And then we did a birthday party in outside of Boston, Somerville, that all nights they were all filled with people. The Bowery one was really, really cool. It was packed with a whole lot of people. There was people from FMU there, and it was great. It was a wonderful night, wonderful performance. So just getting together for the three shows, just because it's tough to get everybody together to do any kind of touring in the country due to the fact that, you know, people live different places, and they like, you know, just to get together and put together a little tour. I don't know. We're getting a little bit older now, and we just pick our spots, I guess, when it comes to Europe and America. But I still do other things.
What's that?
I still do other things. No, I was saying,
in fact, I wanted to ask you about another thing, another project that you've got going on, or at least you contributed to. I want you to tell me about the Amplifier Heads and They Came to Rock, because I've heard the title track. You're singing a lead on it. Do you sing on anything else on the album, They Came to Rock?
No, it's part of a rock opera, some sort of thing, where these aliens come from outer space and they come to Earth, and all they want to do is rock. All they want to do is rock and roll. And it's almost kind of like the song put together was written by this guy named Sal Baglio. He's from here and from Massachusetts, and he was in a band back in the day which was very popular locally called the Stompers back in the early, like in the 80s, and so he got together writing this thing, and he wanted me to just do the vocals on it, and I did my one, you know, tape thing, and he said, that's it, Barons, don't touch it, it's great, it's, you know. We don't touch it. And basically what I'm saying, I'm doing a thing like what someone would do back in the 80s, because it's got that 80s sound kind of in a way. So that was my take on the song. And now it's just like getting played on, you know, all these radio, Sirius radio and internet stations. So, you know, we're doing something on the side, doing a side project.
Are you familiar with Billy Thorpe's Children of the Sun?
No.
No? Well, he's like an Australian rocker. And like in the, when was it, late 70s, he had a tune. And I think the album Here came out on Capricorn. And so it's Children of the Sun. And, you know, a space aliens coming down. And because it was on Capricorn, it came out right before the label folded, and so it was getting all this AOR airplay, and then, you know, the record was gone and nobody could get it, and so, you know, it was like a big collectible thing at the time. But he uses a lot of phasing and hard panning left and right, so the UFOs are, you know, shooting from speaker to speaker. I mean, if you know, it's a pretty yes, if you like, you know, sort of metally sounding things, that was like a holy grail at the time. But it's the same idea, you know, the aliens are coming down, and it's done up like a rock opera kind of thing. But I've spoken with Sal before. We played the Amplifier Heads here in the Underground Garage.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I'm glad that you had a chance to work with him. Do you have some other projects that you're working on as well?
Well, right now it's just I did the one song, but we put together the side band to play just locally around town here and do some shows with a few other guys. So I don't know, whatever he has, you know, I stay in touch with him a lot. So whatever he has for the next, whatever project comes next, I don't know. We'll see what happens. But that just happened to be one of these sessions I went in, I did, and I can't believe what's happening with it and stuff. So it's I'm very, very happy that it's getting played, and I'm sure he's extremely happy and stuff.
Go ahead. No, what were you saying?
No, I was going to say it's all out of also my love of Sun Ra too, because he's another guy who is probably out in space right now saying I'm in a better place than I was on Earth, you know. So
one more thing about the Savages, you mentioned everybody being kind of spread around, or do you have any other shows upcoming?
Actually, I do have a project. Now, this is something that you might be up for. In June, I'm going down to Nashville and perform for the Country Music Hall of Fame. They're issuing, back in 1994, they issued this 4-CD box set of black artists doing country music.
Oh, wow.
That came out.
Yeah.
And they're reissuing it, and I think they've added some another disc of more black artists, current even black artists doing country. And I did a song on it in 94. I did a tune called Irma Jackson, which was written by Merle Haggard, and it's about interracial love, song written in 1968. So I did that through my association with Dave Alvin and Tom Russell, two guys you might have heard of. Well, definitely Dave Alvin, of course. Yeah.
With the Savages, you did the Big Al Downing song, The Georgia Slop.
Oh, I did that.
I guess,
yeah,
well, I guess he played with, that's the rock and roll thing, but he played, you know, with he used to back, played with Wanda Jackson's band and stuff. And then he was also on the Nashville, what is it, the Nashville channel or the country music channel in a lot of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Band.
Yeah, I got to play with him some years ago up here when they did a show with, and it was based on the box set that came out back then. And it was him and Bobby Hebb and me. So it was really interesting night of doing country songs and stuff. But getting back to going down to Nashville, so that's coming out, and they want me to come down with another guy, a friend of mine, Mike Danello, guitar player, and do two songs for this big show that's coming up. And one of them is Irma Jackson, and he wants me to do a tune by Stoney Edwards called Hank and Lefty Raise My Country Soul, another black artist from the 70s. And while I'm down there, I'm going to be negotiating some to do a project on Stoney Edwards, an album of all of his songs, because he's a very important black country artist, I thought so, from the 70s, that really didn't get as big as, say, Charlie Pride or anybody. Yeah. He was very well respected in the country music field.
Man, I look forward to hearing that.
Yeah, that's my thing in June. So they're flying us down and also putting us up to do this show. So I feel very, very important. There's going to be some heavy hitters in Nashville that come to this thing. So who knows? I might be wearing Beyonce clothes.
I think you'd look great in Beyonce clothes.
Yeah.
Well, Matt, right now we can take a listen to one more tune off of the new album, off of Glory. And I want us to hear your version of Right Hand Man. And you mentioned this is a Bobby Comstock song, and that came out of your record collection.
Well, yeah, I'd heard the record online on YouTube. I said, I love this record. So I had someone find the 45 for me in England. And they did find, I mean, a British version copy of it, because the American copy, if you find it, it's worth some buckaroos. So I found a copy of it. I played it for Peter. Peter said, I love this tune. We should do it. So, and we ended up doing it. But Bobby Comstock, he's an interesting character of rock and roll, rockabilly kind of thing. He did a tune called Let's Stomp.
And, right, and that was a hit.
And Tennessee Waltz. But yeah, this Right Hand Man, I really dig it.
Well, Barrence, thanks so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Well, thank you. As I said to you back some months ago when we were touring, I want to thank you for being the sexiest man in Spain.
We're going to leave now with another track off of Glory. It's Barrence Whitfield and the Savages doing Right Hand Man in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
You got guys by the dozen. You can't have my cousin. I'm a guy, can you see? Baby, don't you worry, put your faith in me, yeah. Be a right hand man. To protect you, make me yours and I won't neglect you. I'll be your right hand man.
Be your right hand man.
I'll be your right hand man.
Be your right hand man.
I'll do the best I can. I'll be your right hand man.
Be your right hand man.
I wanna be your man.
Be your right hand man.
I'll be your right hand man.
Be your right hand man.
I'll give you all I can.
Be your right hand man.
That's the way I am.
Be your right hand man.
With a portion of Right Hand Man, that's Barrence Whitfield and the Savages here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Barrence for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. The Losing Streak from Sacramento, California began in the early 2000s. Their latest album is called Last House. It's available from Slovenly Records. Joining me to tell us all about it is their guitarist, lead singer, and frontman, Tim Foster. He's my guest next time around on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.